Hey, what's up, everyone? This is Sam. Today is a very special day for me and the entire Twemmel team. After over 1,200 days of podcasting, interviews with guests from six of the seven continents, Antarctica, we see you, nearly 6 million downloads, and less than 2 weeks away from our very first conference, we are ecstatic to bring you the 300th episode of the show. Coinciding with this important milestone, I am excited to share that we'll be rolling out updates to the Twemmel brand over the next few weeks. When I launched this week in machine learning and AI, I never imagined that I'd be meeting new people who'd see my name or hear my voice and say, "Hey, you're the Twemmel guy." Not to say that Twemmel's a household name or anything like that, but we love this and are embracing it. With that in mind, the show will now be known as the Twemmel AI Podcast. If you head over to twemmelai.com, you can check out our new logo and the refreshed show graphics that accompany this change. Obviously, we want to know what you think of our new look, so please reach out via email, Twitter, the show notes page, carrier pigeon, or whatever works best for you. And now, onto the 300th show. All right, everyone, I am on the line with Kalai Ramia. Kalai is a data scientist at PARC, the storied Xerox research organization. Kalai, welcome to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
Thank you, Sam. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
It is great to have you on the show. You come at data science with a background in transportation, and that certainly influences some of the research that we'll be talking about today. But I'd love to hear a little bit more about your story and how you came to be interested in the intersection of these fields.
Sure. So my undergrad and grad background, like master's background, was in transportation systems. So I was working on a lot of, spatial design of transportation networks and all those things. I was getting bored a little bit of doing the same things again. So I went to grad school in a super interdisciplinary program, which involves transportation, energy systems, econometrics, environment. So I don't even know how to describe it in one sentence what I did. But I had like four advisors just to give a taste of how that was.
I believe that the harder it is to describe what you do, the more interesting it is.
Yeah. So I'll try anyway. So I worked on something called integrated assessment models. So these are the models. They use it to inform, for example, the IPCC reports for climate change, which is the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change. So if they want to inform the public, like what's going to happen in a 2 degrees Celsius policy, then these are all the things that we say in this report using this mathematical model. And this is a humongous model where we solve each sector in a Rubik's Cube format, looking at what are the cost-effective pathways for transportation to achieve the climate goals, or for residential even, like what would be the right amount of LED lights we need to have to achieve this efficiency criteria and so on. So that was my PhD program. So I worked with all kinds of fields to build this humongous model. Specialty, my dissertation was focusing on like including human behavior in light duty vehicles, like how people will be able to purchase different kinds of new technologies and how that will lead to climate goals. So that was the essence of it. And while I was doing that in my grad school, I was getting familiar with machine learning and advanced data science techniques. And I spent a little bit of that in my postdoc on a spatial data. Then I joined PARC. So that's when like I started my interest in deep learning systems and other things on a variety of projects.
That sounds like a lot of fun. And the work that we're going to be digging into today is focused on an analysis of the infrastructure to support alternative fuel vehicles. Can you talk more about your research in that area and how that specific line of inquiry came to be?
Yeah. So in that particular paper you're talking about, I did the analysis on hydrogen fueling stations. So are you aware of fuel cell vehicles?
at the super high level. I'd love to hear your kind of take on where we are with those.
Okay, so I drive one. That is all you need to know right now.
So they exist. They're out on the road. Yeah,
that is the genesis of why I started this paper. It's otherwise commercially called a hydrogen car. Since I wanted to, I have a long drive from East Bay to Palo Alto, so I kept driving on a gasoline vehicle. So I was feeling guilty, so I wanted to get a zero emissions vehicle, right? Everybody was going for electric. Since I worked on these different kinds of transportation technologies, I wanted to see how would it be to drive a hydrogen car. So that was how my research started. Then I got a hydrogen car. So the way these vehicles, go ahead, you had some question.
I will say that I did not associate fuel cell and hydrogen. I'm very ignorant in that area. I thought when I think of fuel cell, I associate that with alternative battery technology, like that we might see in phones or computers or even cars, and hydrogen. I don't know how I envisioned us getting the hydrogen into the cars, but I did not associate that with fuel cell, and I did not realize that they were broadly available today.
Yeah, see, you know something. And you're exactly right. Fuel cell are similar to batteries. So the fuel cells work in a way battery does, like what it works in a Tesla or a Bolt, except that you give hydrogen to fuel cells and then they convert that to electricity and that drives the car. So they are essentially electric cars, but then they need hydrogen to produce the electricity. That's the only difference.
Okay.
So the way they work is, California is the pioneer in this technology. So they have about 32 or 35 hydrogen stations all over the state. And Bay Area and Southern California are big in this network. They have multiple stations. That's one of the main criteria to buy or, to lease a hydrogen vehicle. So I'll get to the machine learning part in a bit.
Consumer perspective, if I don't find a fueling station, I'm probably not going to want to buy one of these.
Exactly.
And I imagine it's not like an electric vehicle where I can just get a box and attach it to my house and, be able to charge my car. The hydrogen infrastructure at the home is non-existent.
You don't want that.
And dangerous.
Yeah, exactly right. So that's why having a public hydrogen station is very important, and having a reliable public hydrogen station is very, very important. Fortunately, I live in Union City. So there is one in Fremont and there's one in Hayward, and I work in Palo Alto and there's one in Mountain View at the time when I got the car. So I was very excited. So the fueling system is very similar to gasoline. So I was doing that. And then over a period of time, I realized some stations do really badly in these. You go there and then suddenly there's no fuel or there's a line or, there's all sorts of problems. And then the other stations, I started to rely more and more. And I was looking for some kind of data for this. Is there a data-driven reliability that I can actually look up so that when I want to refuel, I can go there directly? And there wasn't one, so I started collecting the data. So the California Fuel Cell Partnership is the agency that provides this real-time hydrogen availability data online. So I scraped that data for 3 months from October to December of last year, every hour. And I wanted to see the time series and do all those things to analyze where I can go refuel or where anyone can go refuel. So I did that. And then I got, when you get a zero emission vehicle, you get rebate from the state. If you are buying a Tesla or a Bolt, you can get about $2,500. And if you're getting a hydrogen car, you get about $5,000. And that data is available to the public, anonymized, of course. But you can see who got the rebate at a zip code level, at census tract level even.
So you can get a sense for vehicle density by zip code or census tract.
Exactly. So putting two and two together, so I have this fuel consumption data that I collected for a period of 3 months. And all I have to match it with the demand and see whether there is a trend. Obviously, there was a trend, and you could actually see which stations lag behind and which stations are overstressed. Like, for example, if you draw a linear relationship between demand and supply, I was able to visualize, in this case, Mountain View was not used by people. So it confirmed my instincts that Mountain View sucks. The station sucks. So I was happy about that. But then I don't go by my own instinct alone. So I did a survey of 100 fuel cell drivers. We have this Facebook group of hydrogen car drivers that we talk to each other and talk about the fueling difficulties or whatever. So I put out the question to them. I asked what are some brief 7 questions on like what's their favorite location, what's their least favorite location, what are the things they find difficult to or why they avoid the station and so on. It so happened that many of them picked Mountain View as the least favorite station because the one thing I felt, which was confirmed by others, it had a different setup than other stations. It wasn't user-friendly. That was something, we couldn't have guessed just by looking at the data. And also other things like, some stations are overstressed because there are a lot of people queuing up. So which kind of gives an indication that the station capacity could be increased over time in those places. Mm-hmm. So I wrote this paper initially to suggest that to policymakers, having this kind of continuous monitoring mechanism would be able to help your data-driven decisions over time, whether you want to increase the station capacity or do you want to include a new station in that area because it's overstressed, or if there's something wrong going on with it, if there's unsafe location or something different fuel setup, it'll be able to identify where it's going on and then you can fix it. So that was an interesting paper. So once I did that, so it was published in International Journal of Hydrogen Energy. And then there was another sister paper that's...
And that paper specifically is the one titled An Integrated Quantitative Qualitative Study to Monitor the Utilization and Assess the Perception of Hydrogen Fueling Stations.
Yeah. It's long. Yeah. So I wanted to capture everything in one. It was a very fun paper to write because it was based out of my personal experience and it's full of affirmations like I was right.
That's awesome. Now, in hearing you kind of describe the setup and what your data sources are, one thing that jumps out at me from your personal experience is that there are two sides to the demand equation. There's where the cars live, but there's also the other side of the commute, where you're going. Were you able to find any data to incorporate that side of the demand equation into your analysis?
Yes. Remember the survey I mentioned? So that was one of the questions to the drivers. So where do they fuel and what was the reason why they choose that station? Mm-hmm. And for me, I wanted it to be close to home because that's where I rely most. Or on the way to commute. It so happened that about 70% of the people who answered that why they picked the station was proximity to their house. Okay. So that was my assumption as well, and that kind of validated this. And of course, this is just a preliminary way of analyzing things. And there's always, like you mentioned, this demand, traffic demand, time of day events and all those things that could factor into these things. But for the initial, checking the station performance overall in a broad period of time, I think this might be okay.
Okay.
So if you go through the paper, there are these detailed steps on how I transform the time series into one single metric and all those details, if you like, I can go back to that.
And that's in the quantitative qualitative paper?
Yes, yes.
So this initial paper was kind of talking broadly about this problem and integrating both the quantitative approaches and the qualitative survey that you did. But then you did another paper that really focused in on the quantitative side and in particular the application of machine learning to this problem, or an application of machine learning to this problem.
Right. So since I had access to the spatiotemporal data, so it was rich in terms of like whatever data I collected for 3 months. So it's a very ripe data set to explore different kinds of problems. In this case, I wanted to see if I can do some kind of temporal clustering to identify the signatures of the usage of these stations over time. So I used a temporal clustering mechanism. So I was able to find out, since I had access to the qualitative survey, I was able to even interpret the results that came out of this model.
And so talk a little bit more about the temporal clustering approach that you used. What exactly was your objective and what specific techniques did you apply?
So the objective was to identify if just by looking at the station consumption, will we be able to see whether can we group these stations into different categories, which the paper describes how it's being done. So I identified like 5 categories from the signature of these temporal usage. So the method I followed is something called complexity invariant temporal clustering. So I got this from a research paper. So the idea behind that is for use cases in finance or anything, any domain-related temporal use cases, you can actually find the signatures and in terms of complexities. So you can do clustering of these signatures based on that, and I was able to find 5 groups of those. So one is the healthy range, where we think the stations perform pretty well. And then the other group is the overstressed, where there are being, a lot of people go there more than the predicted demand. And another is where the problem stations, where people do not go and they have a different standards of reporting and such. And the other are like connector stations and are some, the connector stations are those that are placed somewhere in between the high demand and low demand stations. So this method, so I tried with different kinds of clustering methods, and this one, the complexity invariant method, seemed to perform well. We were able to hierarchically group these stations into different categories.
Okay, so you apply this clustering technique, and you're specifically trying to cluster in time series, and then use these clusters to identify the specific, essentially categorize the types of fueling stations. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah. If you recall my previous paper, so that identified the relationship between supply and demand. Mm-hmm. So in this case, we are just using the supply side to identify any problem stations. So by problem stations, I mean, since I have the survey data, I can tell they are problem stations. So otherwise, they are grouped into these different categories, different buckets of stations. Like there will be like majority of stations falling into like healthy range bucket. And then there's these groups of 5 or 6 stations that falling into overstressed or underperforming. So the interpretation comes from the qualitative method that I did. But then this involved performing the analysis even without involving the demand of people. So even if the number of stations scale up in the future, we don't have to worry about who is buying where or who is refueling where. That will answer your previous question as well. So just by looking at the signature of these station usage, we can see whether it's performing in a healthy way or something is wrong with it.
And you just referenced the qualitative survey results, but I'm noting the paper, this particular paper that we're talking about, is unsupervised temporal clustering to monitor the performance of alternative fueling infrastructure.
Right.
So you didn't use the qualitative results or of these stations as labels.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, no labeling done. So we are clustering the stations first. I think the qualitative part comes only in interpreting those clusters.
You've essentially created a way to for a regulatory or a government agency or somebody that cares about this to just look at the time series performance of these stations and their utilization and assess them.
Yeah.
Is that right?
So, yeah, exactly. So the idea behind this is like California plans on installing 100 of these hydrogen stations in a before 2025, right? That's one of the plans to climate change goal plans. So if that's going to happen, we have to make sure people rely on these stations. And that is a part of, you know, building the reliability, because one of the biggest fears, like you mentioned earlier, like if I have to buy a hydrogen car, the proximity alone doesn't matter, but I need to have a reliable station. Like if I go there, I need to be able to refuel. That's one of the biggest fears behind adopting hydrogen vehicles. And that's the reason behind, you know, going after electric, because you can charge at home. So I think for, you know, reducing emissions, we need to follow both technologies for diversity and to adhere to compliance and adhere to follow reliable solutions or, you know, throw out reliable solutions to public. We need to have these kind of mechanisms in place. This is one of the projects, like I didn't see anything happening in the policy realm. So once I wrote the paper, I sent it out to California Fuel Cell Partnership and they were really interested in seeing this further.
That's awesome. That's awesome. It does strike me that once the station is built, it's a little bit too late. Can you envision applying, you know, either the techniques similar to the ones you've written about or other machine learning techniques to do this more predictively to, for example, determine where the next 50 to 70 stations should go?
I think it can happen because the stations are pretty sparse right now. So, for example, if Fremont is having more traffic than usual, then it would be easy to identify where it's coming from. And then, you know, the next station placement can be made nearby so that it alleviates that. Or the station capacity can be increased pretty quickly. That doesn't need a lot of infrastructure cost. So it is just a matter of delivering it more frequently.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think those are the low-cost solutions that can help in the meantime, to help people adopt more zero emission vehicles.
And you mentioned earlier in the conversation, I believe as one of your assumptions, a linear relationship between demand and consumption. Did your paper validate that assumption or did you challenge that assumption in your research?
So I did validate that. I ran all the linear regression assumptions within there. But I also mentioned that within the paper, since it's a sparse placement of stations, maybe this simple relationship is okay for now. But as we add more, the relationship might not be linear. So we have to be careful to extend this to future use cases. If you know, we can't just assume the same factors will apply when we add more. So it is a scalable solution, but we need to be careful of what we are doing.
Cool. So it sounds like this paper was in a lot of ways a passion project, but also mm-hmm. ties into your research at Park. Can you talk a little bit about the connection and more broadly the types of research you're going after at the research center?
Yeah. So actually, I have to say this is completely my passion project. It was not the work related at Park. And you can see why, right? Because I was getting frustrated with the station usage and such. At Park, I have been working on different kinds of projects. So I'm within the machine learning group at Park. And there are different kinds of labs, you know, one for computer vision, natural language, you know, sensor systems, and we have, you know, the printed electronics. They're all part of hardware labs. So my favorite thing about that is I work horizontally across all these labs. So I'm able to pick and work on what I like. So some of the interesting projects that I've done so far, which are not related to transportation or energy, is I developed a graphic design art generation using deep learning. So we did that for a client who wanted to generate, you know, these designs fast on a scalable basis. So we had to deploy these deep learning models onto the cloud.
What kind of designs are we talking about?
So I published or worked something called intricate deep transfer design. So it is like similar to style transfer, where we have a painting and a content. where, you know, the outcome would be a picture that looks like a painting. In this case, I'm using a silhouette as a content, and any pattern in the place of design style. And then the outcome would be these patterns divided into new kind of chunks, so that the output looks abstract. At the same time, it fits the shape of the silhouette. So if you look up, I think there will be one called Deep Quilted Darth Vader, which is one of my signature words. So I gave a quilt design and then a Darth Vader silhouette as a content. And then the output looks, as if the quilt is stitched at the edges of the Darth Vader, as if it's quilted. And it is different from cutting and pasting it because, you know, if you cut it, the finish won't be nice. So we're using this kind of style transfer for that. There are other examples also. Like there's one more thing I did that has a stained glass effect. Like if you use a geometric style, it leads to a stained glass effect. So I tried with different kinds of patterns, and that was one of my pioneer projects at Park. So, you know, you can see like I worked on different kinds of domains there. And I also worked on...
I remember, you're also a comic artist. So this is also tying into your passions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Art is something... So the way I say it, like two things stick me. It's math and art. So this was very cool because I was able to combine two of these things.
You mentioned a client came to you. Are there commercial applications that you can talk about of this kind of work?
Yeah, so the client is a Xerox company. They are like marketing design company, so they wanted to see if they can produce personalized designs, depending on the color or graphic types and such. They really liked it because it was able to do that those things. So if you have a logo, you'll be able to generate something personalized to you. That is the idea behind this.
Oh, awesome. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And you also worked with more projects in the computer vision group on in an augmented reality assistant. So I designed an object detection algorithm for them. And also with dialogue systems with the chat group. And currently I'm putting together my research agenda to do the combined work of, you know, hardware and software expertise within Park. So the idea is to create, so we at Hardware Labs, we produce a lot of sensors, printed electronics and such. So I'm exploring to see how we can use those technologies with machine learning. And, you know, it can be applied in myriad use cases, but I'm looking at energy and climate areas.
And do you have some kind of visibility into or specific ideas into how they apply to energy and climate that you can share with us?
For now, we are just exploring things, but there could be any number of use cases, right? For example, agriculture is a big one. Park does a lot of low-cost sensors. So it can be combined with machine learning to identify what are the some crops that can be grown in a specific region, we have a project on carbon capture. So, you know, we can use all these carbon sensors, humidity sensors, and temperature sensors to identify where are the right locations for those, and how can we verify that carbon is being captured, and so on. So it is still very, very new, like it's in the ideation phase. So I'm still putting together a lot of things. And of course, transportation is a big one among them as well. We are trying to see, so there is freedom to set our own research agenda at Park within reason, so that it has, you know, relevant business use cases too. So I'm trying to match those two together.
Sounds like a fun place to be.
Yeah, it's great. A lot of smart people. Some people have been there since the 1970s, since Park was formed. So it's great to have all their wisdom. Yeah. So it's very nice to be there.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Kalai, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us about what you're up to.
Yeah, thank you so much, Sam. Thanks for having me.
All right, everyone. That's our show for today. For more information on this guest or any of our guests, visit twimlai.com. Be sure to register for TwimmelCon AI platforms today. You can do that at twimlcon.com. As always, thanks so much for listening and catch you next time.